Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody. Today we'll be talking about grave history, death, race and gender in Southern cemeteries. And here today are the editors Camille Fletcher and Ashley Towell. Dr. Fletcher is the Associate Professor of American and African American History at Albright University in Pennsylvania. And Dr. Ashley Towell is an Assistant Professor of History and Women and Gender Studies at the University of Southern Maine in Portland. Now, this is an edited collection that looks at issues of race and gender in deathscapes across the southern states. And it takes a very big historic sweep right up until the present day. And for the most part today, we'll be talking about racial divisions in cemeteries under the Jim Crow laws. But perhaps if it'd be really useful for me if we could start maybe by talking a little bit about burial practices in the southern states before the Civil War. Presumably, there were some species of racial divides. I mean, how did it all work?
Yeah, so I guess I can get us started with answering that question. I think racial divisions in cemeteries are really, they're as old as the United States itself. This was a practice that settler colonists, they practiced when they came over to what would become the United States. Some of the first legislation that's passed in the Virginia colony is actually around segregating burials and making sure that that burials are done not in private either. So they had to be public so that everyone would know who had died and where they were buried. So race was at the center of burial practices from the start. And so there was some kind of legal codification of segregation, but a lot of it was also just common practice that this was just the way it was. So in the South, on plantations, enslavers would set aside separate burial plots for enslaved people, and that's where they would be buried. It was only the select few enslaved people that might get that place of purported prominence being buried with an enslaver's family to show kind of their loyalty. And that was seen as a sign of, that they had been faithful and loyal, and enslavers saw this as being something that was a gift to enslaved people to be buried with the family. For free Black people, they actually would establish their own cemeteries as a way of showing kind of their respectability, their ability to care for the dead in a way that they saw fit, to kind of give their community members the burial that they thought that they were entitled to. So you do see free Black people starting their own benevolent societies and mutual aid societies to be able to establish their own Black cemeteries to provide for the dead as well. Because they didn't want them in these segregated plots, kind of relegated in paupers' fields. They wanted to have a more respectable burial. And Camille, I don't know if you want to talk about kind of how that gets dismantled or contested in the 20th century.
Yeah, no, I was just thinking about when you were starting off burial in the South, right? The South is defined by slavery, plantation slavery, in this country. And so already there's a divide in the living that, you know, these enslavers, these white enslavers were very serious in taking with them into the afterlife. They took this white supremacy with them and into the afterlife. What I found, not just in the 20th century, though, because in studying Mount Auburn in Baltimore, Maryland, what I found is just like, you know, Ashley was talking about these laws, there's a really important article by Rodiger talking about these Virginia laws where Black folks can't gather for funerals. And you also, you see some tension there, because if you constantly have these kind of back-to-back laws in the 1600s, then his argument, which I think is a very powerful one, says that Black folks keep doing it, right? Mm-hmm. They keep gathering, they keep burying. And so you see this kind of acquiescence of the slaveholder, which is this type of activism, right? And that's kind of where my work really comes in. Not just the 20th century, but looking at, you know, what is the origin of this kind of from slavery to freedom story when you're looking at death and burial and cemetery as the vehicle for activism. And so when I'm taking it up, Jim Crow segregation, this legal segregation as of the Homer Plessy, the separate but equal United States Supreme Court, 1896, you see Black folks just saying absolutely not. And they are using the NAACP. They are using all types of grassroots, these benevolent societies from the 19th century to just not be buried in Potter's Field, to not be Jim Crow, you know, to have this very important, you know, really to be able to rest in peace, right? This kind of American idea. Right. Liberty, pursuit of happiness, and the, you know, my burial rights. So, yeah, you know, really trying to look at what's going on with this kind of racial border that defines the South, even in death.
Yeah, it's really interesting, isn't it? Because this happens on so many different levels. Even I was really struck by the discussion of what happens in the cemeteries, even during the Civil War, and the discriminatory practices that extended to the Ladies' Memorial Associations, glorifying the graves of the rebel soldiers and deliberately neglecting the Union soldier graves as being testament to this notion that, you know, to the lost cause that this fight had been, you know, the way in which this fight had been sort of undertaken, really sort of like, it was just continuing. It was this fight was continuing. The war was over, but the fight continued. And I think the cemeteries were such a prime location for that continued tension and conflict as segregation played out in those landscapes, in those cemetery landscapes as well. Not just the separated ones, but even within the segregated landscapes of the cemetery themselves.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sorry, Ashley, go ahead.
No, I was just going to put in a plug for Joy Jaguer's tremendous chapter that looks just at that, using Cave Hill Cemetery in Louisville, Kentucky, to show that exact practice of, here was, you know, a state that never seceded, that was one of these border states, remained in the Union, and yet the cemetery does become very much a Confederate cemetery. This is a national cemetery that the federal government is funding, is burying Union soldiers. Yet the Confederate sentiments there, they really take root in that cemetery. And so Cave Hill becomes this really interesting microcosm for looking at how Kentucky, after the war ended, did really consider themselves to be part of the Confederacy and developed this Confederate identity after the war. And the cemetery was part of that transformation. You can see that in the cemetery.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Yep.
Yeah. No. In thinking about Joy's chapter, I wanted to provide more context. Mm-hmm. You know, when Ashley and I were thinking about putting this volume together, you know, her very important work on national cemeteries in the South, and then what I was doing, we wanted to start the anthology off with the Confederate monument debate. Right. Mm-hmm. You know, that was happening just a few years ago. And your comments made me think about this, that it's not just people who are dying and being buried, but this idea of memory, this mm-hmm. idea of memorial, who gets to be remembered, who gets to be forgotten, and just what's going on there. And in part of that, thinking about memory, right, is how does the South identify itself, right? Because there's a very strong sentiment of, you know, the victors tell the story, right? But in the South, you know, they lost the Civil War. They're able to just tell this story. And even though the white supremacy lost, they're able to still memorialize themselves in some very powerful ways that you were just talking about, the Ladies Memorial Society. You know, these women, you know, that they had garnered so much power that in the early 20th century, there was almost a mammy memorial on the National Mall, right? So a mammy is a Jim Crow caricature of a Black woman. She's dark-skinned, she's heavyset, and she loves massive kids. So what message does that send about the identity of the South, the docility of Black women, the caretaking of the South, right, to her own detriment, right? And so these women, their fathers, their husbands, their brothers, their sons died, and they refused to let them not be remembered. But that's that kind of contention that this volume asks you to really think about. You know, I am a Southerner. I'm from Arkansas. And there's a fascination with the South. We have reality TV shows about Duck Dynasty and, you know, the sayings that we have. And there's a charm, right, that the South has. But it is, you know, almost to the, almost to the omission of the brutality that has happened to both. And there's one kind of narrative. And so we're saying the South has a story to tell. Let's use the cemetery to tell the story.
Yeah, I think you're right. And thinking about the prominent nature of that Southern narrative, really interesting thinking as well. So much of the narrative that fits in this book is about these hidden landscapes, about the stories that these hidden landscapes tell about the communities and how those communities supported each other to honor the homegoing ceremonies. This is an area I found really very interesting, understanding that community, that growth of community resilience and using these structures, the mutual society structures. Can you tell me a bit more about that and how they were kind of developing?
Sure. I think we have a few chapters that are really good at showing, in particular, the work that women were involved in. I think when we look at the Reconstruction period right after the Civil War, historians have pointed out that there is this flurry of institution building that happens, of mutual aid societies, benevolent societies. But a lot of the emphasis has been put on men who were leading these societies. And what I think our book does really well is shows that Black women were really at the forefront of these societies as well. They had this long history of being caregivers for the dead that they take with them into freedom when they establish these societies. So Lynn Rainville, who does phenomenal work on African-American cemeteries, her chapter looks at the Daughters of Zion Cemetery in Charlottesville, Virginia. And this was an organization that was led by women who created this cemetery for African Americans in the community, again, to have a place where they could receive a proper burial, where they could have a proper funeral and a headstone and a place where people could come and visit them and be proud of them. And so this was really kind of a focal point for the community, and the Daughters of Zion as an organization, they had this really prominent role in the Black community in Charlottesville. At one point, they had like their own space where political organization would happen as well, and the community would come together if they needed space for an event. So I think it just shows how central death was to the building of community. And Sherry Williams' chapter does that as well. She did some really, really impressive just research, just digging into numbers and figuring out, you know, how many women were part of the Zephyros, which was kind of the women's arm of the Mosaic Templars of America, which was a big mutual aid society that started during Reconstruction. And what was interesting about her chapter, she was looking at Macon County, Alabama. She found that it wasn't just middle class African American women who were part of these mutual aid societies, but it was lower class women too, who they were willing to use their money to join these societies because they thought that it was a means of uplifting themselves, their families, their communities. Mm-hmm. So this was an expense that they were willing to take on because they saw that it could be this beneficial thing for their families and their communities and kind of ascending into the middle class, perhaps. Mm-hmm.
I know this is slightly off the context of the book, but Cammie, you do so much work on the development of the Black funeral directing industry mm-hmm. in the US. Did these mutual aid societies, what kind of relationship did they have with kind of funeral directing as a business? Was it kind of mutually reinforcing? How did it work?
You know, that's something that I have been looking into. I was writing an article about Black funeral directors. And what I found in Baltimore is that there are these cooperatives that are happening, these cooperative clusters of apprenticeship. I teach you, then I teach my family members. There's just, or I have the horse and carriage for the body to the cemetery. You know, I'm the one that does the coffin. And I got this question about, you know, is there any competitiveness here? You know, surely it can't just be this kind of cooperative nature. And I'm yet to find that's not what the story is. I think there's so much work to go around. You also have to understand that by the time that we're in the 20th century, it's the Jim Crow market, you know, as August Meyer talks about, it's very segregated. So we definitely don't want to fight each other while we're fighting white folks. But these benevolent societies really do come out of a need to pay the undertaker for, you know, what Carla Holloway talks about, our last big performance. It's all about the open casket. It's all about the flowers. It's all about making sure that that body, you know, looks like itself in life. So I think it definitely is a work in this. And I think another big thing when you're talking about African-American undertaking or African-American undertakers themselves, these folks lived within the community. So it wasn't this idea of trying to, you know, just get every dime I can. You know, I've seen countless stories, definitely during the Great Depression, but even afterwards, if a person can't pay, I'm still going to do the service that's necessary. Mm-hmm. So there is this kind of working together, but the benevolent societies really were about pinching their pennies, you know, their coins together to pay whoever, right? The widow's fund really is what they called it, to be able to pay to make sure this person gets that proper funeral.
Yeah, interesting. There's kind of resonances with working class funerals in the UK, that whole notion that the community is supporting itself. And what I really liked about some of the discussion in your book is talking about that search for visibility that comes with the funeral. The funeral is about being as visible and almost as inconvenient as possible for other people, because there is that sort of emphasis on here was a life worth celebrating, irrespective of all of the other contexts that happens, the community is respecting that life and celebrating that life. And you're mentioning a couple of things there about the open casket and about the flowers and the presentation. Do you think this comes, where is this seated? Is it seated within resistance to slavery and the invisibility that comes with slavery? Or is it something that comes from African-American tradition? Is it something that, you know, where does it come from?
I think in our volume, and Ashley would, I think, agree to this, that's really what we were trying to get at. There's a real activist element here. When you're defining the South with a racial border, right, and you're saying that white enslavers literally have the right to life and death, right? And they're controlling it. Then death becomes a vehicle really to push back against that. And that memorial aspect, to be remembered, is just takes the life of its own and becomes very important. But I think scholars of the African diaspora, I think they would look at Africanism. You know, they would look at West African death practices. If we're talking about the Ga people or the Akon folks of modern day Ghana, and say that these practices did survive, right? The transatlantic slave trade. You look at the Gullah people, for example, in the South, from North, South Carolina, Georgia, really on down through Florida. You would say that those practices, you know, did survive. But I think when you look at the ways in which Black folks are dying, and this is something that's running through our volume. I'm thinking about Adrienne Chizinski, her article, where she's talking specifically about, or her chapter, she's talking specifically about the civil rights movement and those martyrs and what happened to those folks, you know, that we are teaching about. We're learning about the four little girls that were, you know, just in the 16th Street bombing, or Emmett Till. I mean, they just did another motion picture about him. I think folks would be surprised to know his casket or the memorial that they have up for him in Blunning, Mississippi, that as of 2018, there was some white college students that shot up his memorial. What is going on there? What are we, you know, how are we learning? What's going on with that? And so when you see the ways that we die, see how, you know, Black folks are marginalized in the national narrative or in the regional narrative, then again, death becomes a way to make it very visible. Our life becomes visible.
And I would just add on to what Cammy said, that was actually the question you just asked is one of the other kind of touchstones of our book and how we started thinking about why we needed this book, because a lot of the scholarship that has been done on African-American cemeteries has focused on that question of to what extent did African culture and burial practices survive in America? How much of that do you see in the practices in America? And while I think that's an absolutely valid question, I think our volume is trying to take it a step forward from that to say, okay, yes, these practices did survive, but what did that actually mean for African American people? Like, how did they then use those practices to affirm their humanity, create communities, push back against the inhumanity of slavery? And so in what ways were they politicizing those customs that they had brought and transformed? And so that's what our volume is taking up.
Yeah, I think it's a hugely valid point, is thinking about, as you say, about how these identities are deployed and in what circumstances, and thinking about those things. I think the it's really interesting in thinking about this kind of resistance to marginalization, and the chapters that sit around sort of like the burial of civil war activists and the martyrs that you just talked about, they're really interesting in unpicking the problems that sit around that kind of memorialization, and in particular, you know, family conflict around the identity of this person as the person they loved versus a symbol of something better or something different. It's interesting to see that. I mean, do you find this as a kind of common story that sits beyond that? Is how we think about people as symbols versus people as loved members of a family, if you know what I mean.
You know, your question makes me think about what we call the mothers of the movement, like seriously modern day. So Trayvon Martin's mother, Mike Brown's mother, you know, these Black men and women, I think Sandra Bland's sister, have gone on to, you know, their loved ones are now involved in politics. Like, they literally have run for city council or some, you know, where in their state, and they have become to continue on this movement. And you just make me think about that. that labor, that's a lot of labor, even if it's a good thing. And it may be in, I think it's in Adrienne Chudzinski's, her chapter as well, where there's scholars that are writing about, they're writing about Black motherhood grief, and they're using Emmett Till, even a portion in my, Emmett Till's mother, even a portion in my chapter, where I talk about this 20-year-old Vietnam vet dies for his country and cannot be buried in a cemetery. And so there's these pictures, these iconography of the mother, these Black women that are just crying and just wailing. And that's political. Because people do not believe Black women are in pain. And that goes into another discussion about Black, about our medical industry, right? And why disproportionately Black women are dying. But I think, you know, what you're saying, it just makes me think about just full circle and how many kind of legs this issue really has when you're talking about the symbol versus the person. And the labor that comes with that and what that means, it is activism. But when this story keeps getting told, then what are we talking about? Are we talking about empathy? Are we talking about humanity? You know, is this a human rights issue, social justice issue? And then again, what role does the cemetery play in telling that story and teaching folks? Which again, which is why we have that lesson at the end of every chapter. You've read about what's going on with these martyrs, and then how can you now apply that? Because we don't want to keep telling, you know, this kind of same story.
Yeah, I think I know I keep going back to the UK and thinking about work that's been done on working class grief and the notion that if you're working class, so you have a lot of children, you don't really care if one dies. You know, your sentiments aren't as refined as the middle class grief. So, you know, that grief doesn't matter. And I think there's that whole notion that certain types of grief don't matter, that the people experiencing those aren't really experiencing them the way that we would like. So they're quite easy to dismiss. So the issue is about grievability and non-grievability, isn't it? Certain deaths are grievable and certain deaths aren't. But I think taking this back to the cemetery and thinking about that landscape, and that, you know, the tropes of cemetery, I know being in cemetery history for a long time, we want these big grand statement cemeteries to express our wish to see death in the past like that. But actually the notion that cemeteries aren't always like that. You know, you know, we're talking about modesty, we're talking about marginality, we're talking about a different kind of story, death, looking at death in the past, that I think is slightly more challenging in some ways in thinking about the people who were excluded from these bigger statements.
Yeah, I think the first chapter in our volume, which is by Scarlett Jernigan, who's looking at Rose Hill Cemetery in Macon, Georgia, I think she gets to that point. She's looking at how her kind of overarching point of the chapter is to look at how you see racial and class divisions that you saw in the city itself also perpetuated in the landscape of Rose Hill. So the most prominent burials are for the wealthy, who were also living in the most like prominent places in the city. And so she kind of maps those similarities between city and cemetery. But what's really interesting about her chapter is she's looking at how enslavers were trying to do this impression management of their character. So looking at some of the most prominent gravestones and what these enslavers chose to have put on their gravestone as like their last message to the world to say, this is who I was. And they say things like benevolent master. They wanted that. That was a source of pride for them. And so I think what our book does is it interrogates the simplicity of kind of last messages that people are trying to send about themselves and tries to interrogate the complexity underneath that and kind of the politics that went into why did they choose that as their final message to the world. This is what I want to show myself as. And so I think that gets at that tension between a person's identity and then who they actually were as an individual. And I think you see that also in Carol Van West's chapter, where he's looking at the victims of the Tuskegee syphilis study. And there's been a lot of work done by community members there to reclaim the cemetery, to talk about what happened to the victims who were part of that study and just how importantly they were treated by the federal government. But at the same time, there's this tension where they don't want that study to be the only identity for these victims, right? That they were victims of the syphilis study. They want them to be treated as whole humans who have dignity, that that wasn't the only thing that defines them. And so through the way that they're memorializing the cemetery and the signage that they're putting up, they're trying to tell this more comprehensive story of their lives that doesn't just put them in this box of being defined by that one thing.
Mm. Which is a hugely problematic. It's very difficult to walk that line, isn't it?
Yeah.
I think one of the other themes that's really strong for me, I think, in looking at this collection is the efforts that are currently being made to protect, enhance, interpret these landscapes. And there seems to be a really welcome sort of, I'm not saying resurgence, but a really huge amount of energy now that's being put into understanding these landscapes and interpreting them to people. And you've got each of the chapters has got really useful little sort of, pointers about how to teach this issue to a whole range of different sort of students from, you know, undergraduate, postgraduate, right down to sort of school level, which is great because it integrates everybody sort of into the story. What do you think are the challenges there that sit in interpretation and preservation?
You know, when you were talking, I thought that's exactly why we ended our volume the way that we did. We ended Adam Rosenblatt and Aaron and Brian Holloway. You know, they're talking about, or Holloway Palmer, they're talking about what now? Like, this is still going on right now. It becomes a reparations issue because you're asking yourself, who owns the land? You know, they're talking about in Virginia, in Richmond. Now you're looking at folks trying to reclaim this, exactly what, you know, other chapters are doing, what Ashley was just speaking about, and they're saying, my ancestors lived here. Here's paperwork proof, right? But now developers are saying, well, we own the land or we have the deed to the land, and they want to develop on that. So I think that becomes a real issue. And then the other thing is that the South does not reckon with itself. The South does not reckon with itself. With this type of crime against humanity, you have the transatlantic slave trade, you have plantation slavery, you have the Holocaust, you have genocide, you have the Trail of Tears. We still don't know who the bad guys are. So when we are in the South trying to tell a story of marginalization or reclamation, you still get issues around neglect. Oh, well, these Black folks left the cemetery in this way. They neglected it. They did not do this. They did not do that. That becomes a competing narrative in what's going on. And all you have to do is pull back one layer and you'll see how during this Jim Crow period, Black folks did not have any rights, or even thinking about it really now, how tough it is. I'm a part of a African-American preservation, like a cemetery coalition. And folks are just talking about how tough it is to restore and preserve. I myself, on my mother's side in Risen, Arkansas, we are trying to preserve land that we know is ours, and yet it's still being encroached upon. Mm-hmm. What do you do, right? And this is what I keep saying, it's a similar story. You know, no longer is it Jim Crow. Now you have these developers who are predominantly white or following a very white supremacist, whiteness type narrative, right? That are saying we own the land. And that's why I started off as saying that it's a reparations issue. But we have not reckoned with ourselves to say that as a country, we have done Black identified folks wrong. Mm-hmm. And this is what they are deserving of. They deserve to be preserved, restored. They deserve to be a part fully of this narrative. And so looking at it through this lens of death, where we believe that everybody dies and there's this equality in death, I think may allow people to step back and be critical of it.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting, isn't it? Because these sites are so vulnerable because they're essential constituency. This is something that really struck me in reading the book and thinking about the communities that had to move as a consequence of development and as a consequence of the segregation laws, had to abandon their dead forcibly, and are no longer in a position where they're able to protect, often because a lot of this protection sits around who votes for what. You know, if you don't live in my area, you can't vote against development because you're not there anymore. And it means it's very hard to protect. But it sounds like, you know, from the way in which the book talks about it, that increasingly as state level protections are being afforded different types, you know, African-American burial spaces in recognition of that historical importance. Do you see that as something that a trend that's likely to expand further?
I don't know what thoughts you have on it. Please, go ahead.
I think we hope so. I think one of the contributions that we hope this volume makes is to show why African-American cemeteries are so important. And to the question that you asked about the difficulties of doing this kind of work and researching Black cemeteries, there is a lack of documentation on a lot of these cemeteries and who's buried there, just because of the nature of, you know, the markers that were used, or if they even kept records of who was buried and what happened to those. But with all that being said, I think our volume shows that cemeteries are one of the most important sources that we have when it comes to studying African-American history. They are in and of themselves an archive that tells us a lot about Black history and community. And so with these places being in peril, with them being paved over to put Tropicana Field or, you know, to make way for a strip mall, that's just another source of history that is being lost. And I think that Adam Rosenblatt and Aaron Holloway Palmer and Brian Palmer's chapter shows this so well in juxtaposing Oakwood Cemetery and the Confederate section in Oakwood Cemetery that is pristine, finely manicured. All of the graves are in great condition. And then just right across the street, you have East End and Evergreen Cemetery that are in complete disrepair, that you can't even see a lot of the graves, that they are grown over with vines. This is where people were putting their trash. It became a dumping ground. And so in that juxtaposition, you see the history that mainstream America has privileged for so long. And it's only been, you know, in the last decade or 20 years or so that I think mainstream America has started to pay more attention to Black cemeteries because of activists who are there and saying that these sites are important and they deserve preservation as a form of reparations, as a form of social justice and activism, that this history needs to be privileged in the same way that Confederate history has been privileged for so long.
Let me jump in and say this too. Ashley, there's a connecting the dots that we're trying to do here. I think if anybody knows anything about it, there's this idea that, you know, every Black person was a slave. So we've got slave cemeteries, and then maybe we've got church cemeteries, and then everybody is buried wherever they want to. There's a real connection that we're trying to show folks is that with Jim Crow, that lasted almost 80 years, that segregated Black folks and denied ownership, denied access to library schools, but also the burying ground, right? There was also a building up of America. There was a whole progressive history, if you will, definitely by the 50s. We're building highways, we're building suburbia, right? And that bulldozed right through Black towns. Right. And so when you're hearing this narrative now, oh my goodness, how did this cemetery get paved over to become a strip mall? How does this cemetery get paved over to become a field or a dog park? How did these things happen? We're trying to connect the dot for people and say, folks, we're fighting. They took it all the way to the top. They took it to the court system, but they weren't protected. And this is what happens. You have a freeway, not once but twice, going through this Black community that also had a cemetery, that also had a school, was self-sustaining. And so when we talk about, like, people are just now grappling with what I think have just been mumblings of Black Wall Street. It was Greenwood, Oklahoma, you know, right outside of Tulsa, right? You had, and it wasn't just one. There were thriving Black communities. Where you had a thriving Black community, you had a cemetery. When that was lost, when the town was literally bombed, then what happened to the ancestors that they revered? So we really are trying to connect the dot with both, hopefully, our readers, and getting them to really think about the South and what did that mean? What legacy is being carried on in the South to the detriment, social exclusion, social annihilation, you know, to some folks? Because even if you can, even those historical plantations, I mean, you still have places in the 20th century where these plantations were turned into bed and breakfasts. A breakfast establishment, even on the Eastern Shore out here in Maryland. So we're still trying to grapple with some of that and just really help folks connect the dots with that.
Mm. I would also just add, I want to plug, I think I've plugged every chapter of the book, but Antoinette Jackson and Kaniqua Robinson's chapter looks at that very issue that Cammie's talking about, where they are studying cemeteries that no longer exist in St. Petersburg, Florida. They're looking at the Oaklawn Cemetery Complex, and which was paved over for Tropicana Field. And they are asking, in the absence of these cemeteries, what can we learn about the Black community through looking at a network of other death ways that were part of this matrix of providing people with a fitting burial. So they look at, in particular, again, the really vital role that women were playing in providing these burials through both hospitals and nursing, through their kind of community organizing to put on funerals and services. And so they're looking at, if you're left, if you don't have the cemetery, which again is this really vital source of information on uncovering the history of Black communities, what are we left with? How can we go about reconstructing these communities in the absence of those cemeteries?
Yeah, absolutely. I think I'm going to draw our conversation to a close. I think for me, it's been a remarkably powerful book. I've very much enjoyed engaging with it. I think it's massively important work. And I think it creates a very, very strong foundation for a new understanding of what these spaces mean, the massive importance of these spaces. So I'm hoping that it'll be the subject of a lot more work, a lot more exploration, a lot more conservation and interpretation. And so I think I'm going to leave it there. So thank you very much to you both. And I hope to meet you again soon. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you.